Tech and Talk Radio about all things all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemon.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Intravenous here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby Campus and Community Radio from Simon Fraser University, where we are located on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Halkomelem and Squamish-speaking peoples. I hope everyone is having a good start to the day. I'm feeling a bit slow this morning. I think it's something to do with the weather being a bit cloudy and misty. But yeah, this morning I am going to be airing part two to the interview with Leonie, who is the CEO of the registered charity Justices Now in the UK. I aired part one last week on Intravenous, so if you would like to take a listen to that if you haven't already, that is up on the Intravenous playlist on the website cjsf.ca. And this is all part of a overall series discussing the structural issues that impact survivor justice for rape and serious sexual offences. So I'm putting a trigger warning right there for this episode, in that there are talks of rape and sexual assault cases, rape myths, and there are some case details that are spoken about. So if that's not something you would like to listen to, you can tune out and tune back in at 11 a.m. for Democracy Now. And you can always put in another Intravenous episode from the website if you want to listen to some women and gender talk this morning. There is plenty of episodes to choose from. So yeah, like I said, I'm going to be airing part two to my interview. As a recap of part one was talking a bit about the background of her charity Justices Now and the background of all of her work. We discussed the educational pieces that she works on for barristers, the barrister feedback loop project that she does to encourage a culture of transparency and corrective action in terms of rape and serious sexual offence cases. We also spoke a bit about the idea that defendants will plead not guilty because they know they have a better shot of being acquitted than being found guilty, and looking into that avenue of where the justice system is failing survivors. We looked at levels of conviction versus acquittals and touched a bit upon the political administrative side to achieving reforms in the criminal justice system. So that's kind of a bit of an outline of what was discussed in part one, which was about half an hour long, and this part two is also around half an hour long. So I'm going to be playing some music as well to break it up, because I get it's a very heavy topic. So I feel like it would be nice to break it up with some music. So a bit of a summary of what's going to be discussed in part two this morning is we talk about the challenges that she's experienced working in this area, the commercialism of the justice system. We looked at rehabilitative justice as a process in sexual violence, whether it's an effective form, risk mitigation strategies, delayed trauma, the invasive nature of the criminal justice system. We spoke a bit about the proposed solution being judge-only trials, which is particularly relevant, I would say, for Canada, considering the Canadian junior hockey team trial that just recently finished and the verdict's going to be given on July 24th, got transitioned to a judge-only trial. So it'll be interesting to see what comes from that, especially since it was traditionally going to be a jury decision-making, but the jury was dismissed twice. So that is a fairly new solution. It was meant to be trialed up in Scotland, but the scheme got scrapped last year. So it has a lot of controversies around it, but yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see what the verdict is from that. So we speak about judge-only trials, and we speak about the hypocrisy of what is justice. In relation to looking at one person being wrongfully convicted to one person being wrongfully acquitted. And there were some interesting points that she made in that area as well. So yeah, that's roughly what the second part is all about. And just an overview, since this is my last live intravenous episode, that I have a couple interviews lined up for the next few weeks that will be airing. So to tune back in for the, I guess, till mid-July for the rest of this kind of series. But I have an interview with my professor back at my university back home called Dr. Dominic Wilmot, and he specializes in looking at jury decision making and rape myths. So we really took a focus on that in our discussion and looking into the rape myths in, I guess, a more of a central focus than I've done with Leonie, and then what I did with my interview after that, which was a discussion with Chloe Hunt, who's the founder of Pace Kit, who I've had an interview with her before on Intravenous, but also Jacqueline Villeneuve Ahmed. I think I've pronounced her second name wrong, but she's the founder of the organization She Matters. And then Patty Derbyshire, who is a senior consultant at Rise Consulting, which we had a discussion relating all of this in a more of a Canadian perspective, looking at Indigenous women and girls and the accessibility crisis in getting access to sexual assault evidence kits. So those will be airing in the next couple of weeks. I would recommend staying tuned. They are some very interesting discussions, and I think it's really interesting talking to people that are, one, actually directly involved in the work, but also in different areas of the criminal justice sector. So with Dom, he focuses more on juries and the actual trial process, whereas with Chloe, Jacqueline, and Patty, they're looking more at the evidence side of things before it gets to trial and the issues there. So it's interesting seeing the issues in different areas. But before we start, I want to start with some music, so it's not just solely this heavy topic. So I'm going to start with a song that I got from the playlist here at CJSF called Ambulance by a Canadian artist, Coco Rose, off of her album Cuddle Funk. I believe I played another song from this album last week, but I think it's really cool music. It's kind of funk soul type of vibe. So we're going to start off with that, and then we'll head into part two of my discussion.
J'ai pris le train ce matin vers l'est ou l'ouest, chercher ce qu'il me reste. C'est peine perdue, plus de retour en arrière, qu'importe la manière. J'ai oublié.
And I was wondering, with obviously you've done a lot of work here in like advocacy and support for survivors and attempting to change the system, what have been some of your biggest challenges that you faced on this kind of journey?
Wow. A lot of suspicion, actually. A lot of suspicion that, you know, we're kind of here to tear down. Well, a lot of suspicion. I mean, you've got this, oh, you know, are you just another feminist group who hates men and is going to destroy men and believes all men are rapists type initial perception, if I'm honest. And then just complete, when initially stepped into this space, suspicion, you know, that's a suspicion that we, you know, not kind of intelligent enough to also not be in denial that, yes, false allegations do happen. But fundamentally, it's not statistically the same as the level, right? So our idea is, okay, look, so what's, like, why is it wrong to use? So say one person has been falsely accused. How is that any different to one person being wrongfully acquitted? Why are they not as bad as each other? That's the whole point we make. That should be enough for people to get outraged. If they're outraged at a false allegation, get as outraged for a wrongful acquittal. That's what gets me so frustrated, because it's always, what about the, because, and actually recently on a program that I helped, and somebody else said this again, they went, well, no, because the system has to be the way the system is, because, you know, the impact of a false imprisonment is just so awful. Yeah, it is. Of course it is. It's absolutely horrendous to be accused of something you haven't done. Absolutely horrendous. But so is also living, knowing that somebody has raped you and has got no, there's no justice, and you've been through a system that tells you that you're a liar, that tells you they're this, that tells you they're that, that basically re-traumatizes you often. That's just as bad, surely. Mm-hmm. So firstly, it's getting that narrative across. Is there not a purpose here about justice? What is justice? Is justice on the side, just the side of the offenders, or can justice be on the side of, you know, so that's been a challenge, first of all. But, you know, slowly, I suppose, building up some of that. But, you know, there is, in terms of research as well, there is certain people who will deny that rape myths even exist, despite 50, 60 years of research. Okay, so that's frustrating. But there's a bigger majority who can actually acknowledge it. I would say challenges have been, you know, sometimes it's, you're not from the law community, so how dare you tell us what we're doing is in any way, you know, overzealous advocacy. Or anyway, the way of overcoming that is, to be honest, don't always get that. People have often found, you know, barristers, they are, because that's the very nature of law, looking at, you know, defence barristers actually often come into it for the, because they have, they don't want to see miscarriage of justice. So I think overcoming that, but also I think it's, it, yeah, it's mainly that, really, just people's assumptions that you're here to sort of tear a system down and just totally destroy it, and you know, then that's, you're out for some form of vengeance or something. You know, it's ridiculous when you're actually like, look, complainants' voices matter, their experiences matter, and if nobody can see that because you're so focused on the accused, you know, then what hope do they have? Like, they're just a sea of people who've walked, you know, and men, male victims as well, may I add, who've lost many cases, male on male rape. And there's just this sort of, to me, it's just a trail of these complainants who just, right, well, what's next?
You know,
it's the, you know, so it's just, it just don't sit right. It's just never sat right with me, this hypocrisy of what's justice.
Yeah.
You know, a hypocrisy of alarmism. You're alarmist on one side, but not alarmist on the other. At least be alarmist on both sides, because that's the only way you get some form of understanding. And also, I think there is, in our own discipline, so actually I do think within feminist organisations, we'd be classed as feminists, you know, I think there also has to be acknowledgement of the other side sometimes. Like, you do need to say, we do need to work with both sides, and we do need to look at a bit of a middle ground. We do need to give a bit of, we need to sometimes change our narratives. Just because it's an inconvenient truth doesn't mean it's not a truth. You know, I have, you know, because we could go in and we could want all of our court observations to be negative, because that would match our narrative, right? What we perceive. Actually, sometimes it's not. sometimes it's better than we perceive that situation to be. It's not there yet. There's a long way to go. You know, I'd love to see this best practice across, but it's not. You know, being it's commercialism is the problem. You've got commercialism in a justice system, which is not the state. They don't get paid a lot, actually, defence barristers in criminal space. It's another reason people don't want to do it, unless you, you know, get a lot of work. But it's still, it's a strange situation. And I think that's why the judge-only model has also been tested in Scotland. And there's different pillars of that. For example, Dom, if you mentioned, you know, our trustee, amazing advocate, and so blessed that he's been involved with the organisation, really advocated for the complainants' voices and journeys. But you know, he's less on the potential of the single judges, whereas my positioning is actually maybe that would be a better solution.
I do find it, I hadn't thought of it the way that you've said it, and I'm like thinking of how true it is that we do have this focus on that one person wrongfully convicted is so horrifically bad, but not addressing what about the one person that has to sit and watch their offender walk free with no punishment whatsoever on what they did to them. And I think that's so hard hitting, because I remember one of my first lectures with Dom, of him saying that we have this, the way our justice system is structured is that we heavily focus on making sure we don't wrongfully convict anyone, rather than looking at making sure that people that should be found guilty aren't just walking free. Because he was just saying that we'd much rather have 10 people that did it walk free than have one person that didn't do it in prison. And it is that focus on that you see so many survivors then having to battle with how they move on with their lives. And also you have the risk in the extreme cases of if their offender walks free and then chooses to come back and pay them a visit because of then putting them through court and things like that. And then you're getting into a lot of issues, and we're seeing a rise in like femicides and things like that globally. And that's another thing that I've spoken quite a bit about on the radio, is that I don't think that's being talked about enough, is the level, the extreme in that globally gender-based violence is on the rise, and it is leading to a lot more women losing their lives because of it. And it's the justice system isn't addressing that in any way.
It's not really fit for purpose. And you know, in the you know, in terms of also the English justice system, is the infrastructure's crumbling, the underinvestment, it's not fit for purpose. It really isn't. And the justice, you know, justice will say that. People working in it. But it's still not an excuse for some of the treatment, you see. But you're so right. It's a very difficult lived experience, isn't it? Well, people say, well, these people, yes, he's wrongfully acquitted, but they still get their freedom. But they don't get their freedom, because it's not a freedom to spend your life in fear. And it's not a freedom to spend your life. It just messes up so much, you know, so many things. Like I said, I've seen people, alcohol, drugs, promiscuity is a way of dealing with difficult feelings, family breakdowns, children traumatized. When that person who I think would be wrongly acquitted, what do they get? The opportunity to reoffend. You know, it's just really is that deep. Is what is the notion of justice? And I get frustrated when I hear people say things like, well, you know, it's about justice should be about getting people to fit us, you know, how do you say the word?
Rehabilitation.
Yeah. But the thing is, I don't get is, and if you speak to people who work with offender management and look at sexual violence, you can't just train people. It's not like a HR exercise in a corporate. You can't train people out of sexual violence, because the point of sexual violence is because it's a perversion. It's something that they enjoy. There may be guilt after something. That's the crux of it. It's like the people who are paedophiles enjoy doing it. And you're changing a DNA pattern, essentially, of people. That's what they enjoy. So this wishy-washy kind of, well, they'll be fine. They, you know, they won't reoffend. They'll put, it's just, there's such small pot of evidence that ever even works, that re-education piece. Yes, in domestic abuse, there has been. Sexual violence is a different world altogether. really is. I can't state that strongly enough, that frustration. And if there was more of a focus on offender behaviour and the actual... So it is about power, don't get me wrong, but it is also about sexual desire. And they call it sexual deviancy. It's also about what they like. You know, if you look on the internet in terms of, as well, things like rape porn, it's such a staggering amount.
Mm.
So it's not to say, you know, fantasy. Most people, okay, they have a fantasy of it. They never do it. That's fine. People have rape fantasies. Women can have rape fantasies. It doesn't mean they actually want to be raped. But there is some people within this space who will be watching that. That is the thing that will always resonate with them.
Yeah. You
know? And I speak on this through, obviously, say people who work with perpetrators and actually seeing that in a perpetrator, somebody who worked, who explained it to me.
Mm.
It's a danger. It's a real danger. And again, I don't think people see it like that.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's one of those things of saying, absolutely, that sexual violence is a whole other ball game compared to domestic abuse and things like that. And where rehabilitation may fit for some cases, it's not going to fit for all, I don't think. And it's the same with, I'd say, the justice system. The way the justice system is structured isn't going to work for every type of offence. And it's very clearly seen with the severity of rape and sexual assault cases that these cases are way too complex for the justice system structure that we have now.
Yeah.
And like I would say I had kind of an opportunity where I was called up for jury service last year and I served on a sexual assault case. And looking at my experience in that and the evidence that we were given and the fact that the way that I would say people on the jury, we all had this conception of like, we all need concrete evidence to be able to convict someone. You'd need pictures, you'd need video footage, you need to actually have proof that the defendant was there and did that. And all we were given was testimonies from a lot of different people. And so that was the big thing of a lot of people spoke about, how the hell did this get to court and to a trial on just testimonies? How do we decide this based on stories that aren't adding up? No one's stories matched. And it was a kind of he said, she said situation. And it's where I remember I spoke to Dom after I had my 2 weeks of jury service to talk to him about my experience. And I said to him, I don't understand how this works, because in sexual assault and rape cases, you're not always going to have the concrete evidence of the photographs or the DNA or video footage. So how are they meant to get justice based on just story? Like, not stories, but based on just testimonies.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, yeah.
But that's such a common, I'd say, factor in these cases. And the justice system just doesn't cater towards that, because it needs to be a lot more specialised for... This is the evidence that you're getting. This is most likely the evidence, because so many survivors are not going to come forward straight away for whatever reason.
Right. And it comes down to sort of the legal side of it, isn't it? It's reasonable belief, which is sort of subjective. And they do always say that. They're very good at saying about the evidence, the concrete evidence, you can't convict and this, but where do you go with that? So, right, it's a very difficult system.
Yeah, and it was, I remember the judge as well, very much, there was a lot of emphasis on, you have to be beyond reasonable doubt to be able to convict. If you're not beyond reasonable doubt, you have to go not guilty. And I remember toying with that, because we had a deliberation that lasted about 2 days for this case.
Yeah.
And I remember toying with that when I went home after hearing the evidence and after giving those instructions. I said, but how do I measure what's beyond reasonable doubt? How, like, what is the measurement of that? And I just thought it was a very interesting experience, and I was very glad I got to experience that. But it was one of the most challenging things I'd done, because I was thinking that everything just seems not, it doesn't make sense, if for lack of a better way of putting it.
Exactly.
And things like that. So you've said that you have a bit of a different view kind of on judge-only trials to some other people. So what are your views on sort of specialised sexual offence court systems, judge-only trials, instead of jury decision-making?
I think it would I personally think it would make a huge difference, actually. Hopefully, I mean, I can't say that actually, but I think I think people, you know, sometimes they even say like they don't train a jury because you can't train a jury as well. But things like that, like I just think it's like you just described. It's just such a huge space to even if you've walked off the street and never even looked at this topic ever. I mean, it's just going to be like, why would I quit? I mean, why would I convict? Really? Because it's so difficult to be on reasonable doubt. So I think, yeah, I mean, some people are worried, obviously, the judges would have bias. But I think if you had the right type of judges and gone through the right process, and I think, not sure that you can't call it. But I personally, I know most barristers I work with, by the way, absolutely love the jury system. They don't think it's perfect, but they love the jury system. I personally, my perspective, but that's just me, the difference. I think this is so flawed. It's just so flawed. And also, you know, when they did a recent trial, even on a murder case, didn't they? They did a UK thing where they had two judges, juries on this trial, and they both picked different outcomes. It's just a worry. I think you have to have some forms of, like, you know, in businesses and high risk situations. So if you're an oil and gas company, for goodness sake, you have internal controls and health and safety because you know your risk factors and you know your, like, enterprise risk management. Where is that in the justice system? You know, like, this is a high risk. You've described all the challenges for a jury system. It's a high risk space. So put some risk mitigation strategies in place. Do something like that. You know, it's just so abstract sometimes. It's just baffling.
Yeah, I remember saying to Dom, because I spoke to him in length about my experience and that I bought. So we got given these kind of pamphlets at the start. So I served on two trials, so I got one at the start of each trial, kind of explaining what your role is as a juror and things like that. And I noted that on the last page at the very bottom, in the kind of the smallest font, was a support link if you felt you needed to talk to someone after the trial. And I thought, yes, there needs to be more done in terms of support there for the complainant and things like that in court. But I was like, but also, where's the support for the jurors that are also going through this? There was nothing really there. And I did feel a bit at the end of definitely my first case of just being a bit like, now I just feel like I'm left kind of just in the lurch with this information. I wasn't even involved in the incident, but because I was involved in the outcome, I was sort of a bit left like, now what? Because you're toying between, did I make the right decision? Did I speak up enough in deliberations? What if we were wrong? And things like that.
It's just awful. It's such a, I think that's a huge burden to place on people. Huge burden. And then you can sort of feel complicit.
Yeah. And it's also, you don't get the choice. Yeah. You don't get the choice to say no to jury service unless you have extenuating circumstances as to why. Like, you have to do it. So it's like, being almost felt like I was forced to have to be there. And yes, it was a rewarding experience in some aspects, but it was also, well, now that's kind of altered my life in a way that I didn't really get a say in it, almost. And that leads me on to kind of one of my other questions for you, of what you think for you a trauma-informed justice process would look like in practical terms, from like the moment of